Good morning. It is a privilege for us today to have as our guest speaker one not at all a stranger to this campus. For he served as professor of systematic theology from 1960 through 1981 and the seventh president of this institution from 1975 until his election as president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in 1981. The Reverend Dr. Ralph Bowman was born in 1932 in Palisade, Nebraska, the son of Pastor and Mrs. Arthur Bowman. He graduated from St. John's College, Winfield, Kansas, in 1951, and from this seminary in 1956, from which he also received his STM. He was a Fulbright Scholar at Heidelberg University, received his PhD from Yale. Dr. Bowman served congregations in Des Moines, Iowa, and Pagedale, Missouri, and also served as instructor in theology at the then Concordia College, Milwaukee. He has served our Lutheran Church Missouri Synod in countless ways throughout his many years of ministry, including distinguished leadership on the Commission of Theology and Church Relations, involvement in the Lutheran Council in the USA, and many national interconfessional and inter-Lutheran dialogues. He has authored many books and articles, including his Principles of Biblical Interpretation in the Lutheran Confessions, a text much appreciated and used in our courses here. And he continues to serve as an essayist and speakers at conventions, conferences, and forums throughout the world. Married to his dear Pat for 40 years this April, the Lord has blessed them with two children and crowned their lives with blessings too numerous to count as they have enjoyed faithful service in the Lord's church. As a student of Concordia Seminary, beginning my studies here in the fall of 1974, I had the unique privilege to rejoice with our campus community together with the church at the election of Ralph Bowman to the presidency of this institution. As a student and student association officer, I had the privilege of working closely with Dr. Bowman, and I recall the genuine collegiality he encouraged and modeled for faculty and students. During difficult days, he provided firm, faithful, always pastoral, evangelical leadership. Leadership from the very heart of the gospel. At the request of many students, upon my arrival and short tenure here, I have asked Dr. Bowman to address us today on the rather broad topic of the walkout, an event that occurred 25 years ago, the spring of 74. Reflecting upon these difficult and stormy days in our church, I've asked him to provide us with a broad sweep of the history and a brief analysis of the events that surrounded the walkout. I realize that the time allotted for him to accomplish this is not nearly enough. I do hope, though, that the time for questions will enable you to address more directly your concerns about this momentous event in our church. Praying the Lord's blessing upon his presentation and his time with us, would you now join me in welcoming the Reverend Dr. Ralph Bowman.
Thank you. I know I should say Dean Rockman or Professor Rockman, but you've always been Larry to me, and I thank you for a very, very kind and gracious introduction. I hope you're around when comes time to speak at my funeral, when I can't defend myself. But thank you, and thank you also for the leadership you gave as a member of a wonderful student body. many, many years ago in the rebuilding of the seminary. It took people like you, Larry, to do it with the Lord's blessing. Greetings to all of you, and thank you for coming to a room that, of course, has many, many memories for me as a both as a student and as a teacher, as a president, but a room in which many significant events in the life of the church were held. For example, a so-called theologians' convocation in 1977, and the list goes on. I had thought maybe we'd still be meeting in what is now called President's Hall, Pritzlaff Hall, where they have those ghastly pictures of former presidents, and I'd at least have an opportunity to tell you which one of those was supposed to be I. The first time I saw it, my wife said, "They've got a green tie on you. You've never owned a green tie." And she saw to that by buying always the wildest one she could. So they did repaint the tie. The other thing, well, of course, that room, as we speak about the walkout, is the very room in which the vote was taken in February of 1974 to leave. And a room that holds many, many memories. Council of Presidents meetings, joint faculty meetings, and just all kinds of things. I oftentimes, when I'm in there, look at a couch over there and remember, oh, that's the one I frequently dozed off in during a faculty meeting. Or that's where I sat when Dr. Peepcorn cried at a very, very difficult time in the history of the seminary. And that's where Dr. Ted Nickel, now in heaven, stood as Dr. Preuss had spoken to the faculty, that's Dr. J.A.O. Preuss, and said some words of kind and evangelical correction to a member of the faculty who'd gotten a little bit out of line. All those things. Mostly my memories of the seminary are of students. The relationship of teacher and student is just something special. And as I see professors in the audience, some of whom were my students, all of whom I hope were my friends, it's the students and your response to the Lord's call and your desire to give everything of yourself, to equip yourself for that call, that still is one of the finest things I believe that I have experienced in my life. One more thing. Larry, and may I call you Larry at least for an hour? Maybe no one will hear. The clock back there on the back of this always has memories. I mean, for anybody who's tried to deliver a 7-minute sermon, you know, that's on KFUO or the like. But the one I remember most is as a student when one of my professors, Dr. Ray Winkle, the name may be familiar to some of you, the author of a book called The Flood, and a very dynamic man who spoke with great gusto and went on and on and on every time he spoke. He just couldn't help himself. Well, one day students got the bright idea to paint a clock face. You know, chapel was supposed to be over at, let's say, 10 to 11 because it was broadcast. And they painted a clock face with about 13 minutes to 11 up there. And Dr. Ray Winkle, bless his heart, over here, he just went on and on. He kept looking at the clock. I have just a few more minutes. And So I say that to give you just a word of warning. You notice it's stuck on 3:32. So if I'm supposed to finish at 5 to 11 or so, or 10 to 11, I don't know how long that's going to take, Larry, but we'll give it a try. Well, we're here to do some reflections on the walkout. I must tell you that's a very hard thing for me to do personally because I was so terribly close to those events and to those people. And if I may just be personal for a minute, I want you to know what I was doing and where I was at that time. Technically, I was on a leave of absence at the time of the walkout and throughout that entire school year. I had been chosen as the executive director of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations, the same position that Dr. Nafsker has now held for 25 years. By the way, it was in December 73 that he accepted a call as my assistant. And how wonderfully he has served. But I was on a leave of absence as the executive of the CTCR. We were still living in campus housing, but we lived off campus on Arundel. And many of the events and the trauma of those days, almost impossible to describe. I mean, how it affected your children, your wife, seeing another spouse in a grocery store who wouldn't speak because we were voting on different ways, and you know, all those things. I was spared a little bit of that because I was the CTCR exec. I worked very closely with Dr. J.A.O. Preuss in that capacity. He used the CTCR exec just a little bit differently, I suppose, than I did as his successor, and I think as President Barry does today. I was, in a sense, Dr. Preuss's assistant in many respects, and that's why some of the events that I report on today or respond to your questions on are events that I saw very closely from his perspective and, of course, from that of my colleagues on the faculty. But I can't stand before you and make claims to being totally objective in my point of view. I'll certainly try to be fair, however, and I pray that in our comments to each other, whether it's today only or at some future time, that we can avoid any kind of triumphalism, any kind of pity, that our conversation will not add to anyone's hurt or pain. There's a great deal of hurt and pain that's still alive, and you want to say, well, no, alive and doing hurt in the church of ours. Still a need for some reconciliation in the church on a lot of these events. We're talking about a story that was the major national religious news story in 1974. It had already been that for a year or two because of what preceded it. It was a very it was everywhere. You could not avoid the so-called walkout. Likewise, may I just say a word about the date of the walkout, because that's somewhat ambiguous as well. You basically have to talk about a one-month period from roughly January 20 to February 20, 1974, as the time of the walkout. And if there's time here, I mean, in my notes, we'll show how in January, Dr. Teachin's suspension on the 20th of January led the student body and then the faculty to vote for what was called a moratorium on classes. They simply wouldn't go to class, and the professors wouldn't teach, and they scattered all over the church body to talk to congregations and people and tell their story. And we'll get to that in a moment. It was in February that the chain of events occurred that resulted in two ultimata being issued, one by the faculty that came to be the Seminex faculty. In those days, we called them the faculty majority, telling the Board of Regents, which was then the Board of Control. Incidentally, if I saw correctly, Charles Burmeister and Gene, is that you back there, Gene Finke? There are two members here this morning of that Board of Control that had to work through all those terrible and difficult decisions. At any rate, back to the faculty majority had given the Board of Regents about the 12th, I would think, of February, 13th maybe, an ultimatum that either you rescind actions you took in your last board meeting in October, and I'll come to those in a moment, either you restore Dr. Teachin to his office, which had been suspended on the 20th of January, or in about a week, theological education will be resumed again but it will not be under your auspices. Well, the Board of Control rightly saw that as an ultimatum. You've got to reverse what you did and do this differently, or we're not going to be here. The plans to form Seminex were not really that spontaneous. In fact, I have some evidence here that I quote from, which I probably won't get time to do, but I also, in the days I served first as acting president from May 74 to May 75, and then thereafter, found materials in the files of the president's office that prove conclusively that the foundation of Seminex, I'm sure you all know that's a kind of shorthand for seminary in exile, that the plans for that were beginning to be made already in the summer of 1973. At any rate, the board responded to this ultimatum, either reverse yourself on Dr. Teachin and the other things you did in your recent board meeting, or we will start teaching. Remember, there had been no classes since the 21st of January, but it will not be under your auspices. They responded with an ultimatum of their own, made in a Sunday board meeting on February 17, that said, we want to hear from each professor by noon tomorrow, February 18th, that you are planning to be in your classrooms teaching again on the morning of February 19th, or you will be considered to have terminated your contracts with Concordia Seminary. It was obvious to anyone looking at the board's action that it had been carefully crafted with good legal counsel. In other words, you have until tomorrow to decide to get back to work. You've been called by the church to teach. You either return to doing that on the 19th, or you will be considered to have breached your contract. Well, those were, and I'm really getting ahead of this, I should have started somewhere else, but what the heck. This is kind of the difficulty in pinning down a time. Those days, the 17th, 18th, 19th, 20th, were, as you can imagine, impossible days. I was, as I say, not here myself. I was working downtown at the Synodical Office Building, though living very, very close, and knew pretty well what was going on at all times. The faculty decided not to. There was a meeting of the student body, very emotional. Dr. Herb Miller, whom we buried just a few weeks ago, was Secretary of the Synod, head of the Commission on Constitutional Matters, had offered to meet with the student body at that time to tell them about a new ruling that had been given by the so-called CCM, which obligated the Board of Regents to conduct an interview process with each member of the faculty majority to sort it all out, who held to the doctrines that were condemned and by the previous convention and so on. They refused to hear him. At any rate, the students decided no way, and the professors decided no, we're not going to return. And on the 19th of February, the so-called funeral of Concordia Seminary took place. I don't know whether anyone has ever put the pictures together into a video presentation or not, but I have seen them many times, and I'm sure many of you have too. Crosses were in the quad with the names of students. The big arches in Walter Arch were boarded up, and the words exiled were written across them. And of course, the media were here to record all of it. And on the morning of February 20th, classes began at a place on Grand Avenue under the auspices of Eden Seminary and St. Louis University's Department of Theology, hence the technical name, joint project in theological education, and that was the beginning of Seminex. On Grand Avenue, by the way, that's in the area right near Fox Theater and across from Powell Hall in the 600 block of Grand. So that, when you say the walkout, as you can already tell from my wordy condensation of this, somewhere between the 20th of January and the 20th of February. We're right exactly in that time frame right now. It didn't totally shut down the seminary. A number of students continued, and professors continued, to meet for class. Some estimated 40 to 50 continued to show up for classes. And the five professors who had voted against this did their best to teach them, but greatly assisted by guest professors from Springfield, just 100 miles up the road, some retired pastors, people like, I see Dick Warnick, now on the faculty again, but who was then called to be on the faculty and installed in 1974, and the list goes on. Well, let me go back to doing what professors must do, and that's to refer you to some books that give you some more information. And then I'm going to do a very quick analysis of some events that led up to that event, and a few words on the rebuilding, and then perhaps we can do some questions. First of all, in terms of books, I haven't written anything on it other than the official report of the Board of Regents to the 1975 convention. And if you want a 5 or 6 page summary of what went on from the viewpoint of the Board of Regents and myself, those pages from the convention workbook 1975, that's pages 303 and following, give you a very terse summary of what went on. Longer treatments, we would mention the book by John Teachin, which I don't have here, so I'm not going to read that to you. John Teachin was, of course, the president whose suspension triggered a lot of this, has written a book on his experiences called Memoirs in Exile, Confessional Hope and Institutional Conflict. Another one, James Adams, who was the religion writer for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, has written a book called Price of Missouri and the Great Lutheran Civil War. That was published in 1977. I think it's quite biased. It has some data in it that are simply not accurate, but it's very insightful and has some interesting things. One that gives you a longer range background and a more of a theological analysis is by Kurt Marquardt, a professor at our sister seminary in Fort Wayne, whose book entitled Anatomy of an Explosion gives a rather theological description of the years before and what was going on in the greater context. But I must say, even though I helped prepare it, the best treatment of it is the Board of Control's book called Exodus from Concordia, a report on the 1974 walkout, which the board issued in 1977. The chief author was Pastor Greg Smith, who's at Christ Memorial in Afton. I don't know, some of you might know Greg. He was here, stayed on an extra year to help pull together the pictures and things, and I was the editor and wrote a fair bit of it myself, and it was made available to members of the Synod through some financial gifts from laymen in the church who wanted this story told. So if you have time sometime, it has a lot of pictures, and lots of things are quoted so that you can form your own opinion. Those are some sources. I want to also pay tribute very quickly to people who know a great deal about this, who are still in your midst. As I look at the catalog, I believe there are only two names listed as faculty members who were on the pre-Seminex faculty, and that's Richard Klan, who is retired in Florida in his 80s, and Coach Eldon Peterson, who lives nearby and was our coach and athletic director for many, many years. The saying was always that we students learned our theology in the classroom and our Christianity in the field house from Coach Pete. He was such a, any of you know him or played for him, and I know some of you did, he was such a dear Christian gentleman. And I often explain it when people ask why I was chosen acting president in May of 1974. Martin Charlemagne had been acting president for 85 days from January 20 to a nervous breakdown in April. And Robert Price, whose son, Daniel, I think, over there, now is the director of Concordia Historical Institute. Dr. Robert Price was the vice president, and after Dr. Charlemagne became ill, was the leader of the seminary from mid-April to mid-May for a period of about 35 days. And then I, who had been the exec of the CTCR, was pressed into service as the acting president. I often used to point out that that was tremendously kind of an awesome job for me. I wasn't very old, I didn't think, 42 or 3, something like that. And yet when I saw the dilemma the board was in, the bylaws required the acting president to be a member of the faculty. Well, you stop to think about it, there were only about 5 or 6, 7 maybe, left on the faculty. Two of them, Ed Krentz and Wally Wegner, were on leave of absence, and actually I was too. You couldn't have appointed Wegner and Krentz because they had signed all the faculty documents that had been condemned by New Orleans. You wouldn't choose Robert Price, it was felt, because although he was quite competent, he was the brother of the president of the Senate, and that wouldn't look right. Larry Wunderlich was in his 70s and emotionally a little bit hurting, wasn't felt to be up to the task, and it kind of left Coach Pete and me. And I often say, they looked at that and said, well, maybe we could get Coach Pete to handle the athletic department and be the dean of the student. And then since I had some academic experience, we could, I would be the president and all of that. And whenever we needed a faculty meeting, Pete and I would just call the other fellows and we'd go over the commons and have one. But there were many others, and again, we're not here to hear a lot of names, I suppose, but people who joined this faculty, there were 14 men called in May of 74, the same meeting that named me as acting president, called 14 men, and there wasn't a lot of attention given to what department and all, but a number of them came and helped this seminary tremendously in the rebuilding years that followed. Some are here with us this morning. I pay tribute to them and to all the faculty in those days whose love for students and for the church made a sustenance of the seminary possible. Art Groudon was installed in 74. Eric Keel I saw back there. Bill Schmelder later in that year. Dick Warnick is here. Lou Brighton is here. And I don't remember anymore exactly when a lot of others came, but it was very close to 74 or 75, people like Dr. G, Dr. Rosso, Dr. Hummel, Dr. Wayne Schmidt, Jerry Eichmann, who's here this morning, Tom Manteuffel, and of course John Johnson was a young and aspiring graduate student in 75 on, hadn't even gotten his first doctorate yet. But it was clear that if we could get him to stop, getting doctorates after 2, that maybe we could put him to work teaching, and what a blessing John has been to the seminary. So wonderful faculty. Gladys Silflo, I believe I saw back there. She assisted me and many others in all kinds of things in the seminary in those days. There were just a lot of folks. Well, how did all this come to happen? I'd like to do both a, perhaps there's time, say a little bit about the immediate time before this walkout. How does this happen? And then say something of longer range. Well, maybe it makes, let me start with the longer range stuff. Throughout the history of Lutheranism in America, there has been a tension of a kind between a more conservative, biblical, confessional Lutheranism with a tendency to be more isolated from other Lutherans and other Christians on the one hand, and a second tendency within American Lutheranism. Here already when our founding fathers came in 1839 and the following years, a more open, at some times, a time, for example, that was called American Lutheranism, and the time of the definite platform, Simon the Schmucker and other names like that, a more open, a less, how should you say it, a less strict in its understanding of biblical authority and a confessional subscription. And these two tendencies within Lutheranism have sort of bumped up against each other for 150 to 200 years, even before the Synod got here. Our history is just sprinkled with examples of this. As you move closer to the time of the walkout, there are all kinds of events that you could point to in our church body, but and perhaps I should attempt that. Beginning already in the 40s, tension over whether or not fellowship should be established with the American Lutheran Church, and when it was voted in and then not implemented, a lot of concern. It led to, among other things, led to a statement of the 44 in 1945, which had four or five faculty members from this institution on it. In the 50s, well, there was a protest movement launched that had as its major publication the so-called Confessional Lutheran, edited by Paul Bergdorf. That was before there was a Christian News, but it not a whole lot. In the 50s, I remember because I was a student here. Professors would sometimes in the classroom speak of Concordia Seminary, and especially of Missouri Synod, in a way that we responded with chuckles and laughs and embarrassment that we were isolated and not really with it. Publications in the 50s and the 60s began to, by professors here, began to explore a slightly less strict position on the scriptures and a slightly more open position toward other Christians. And it just sort of goes on and on. By the time of the 59 convention, a resolution was adopted called Resolution 9, which said that all pastors, teachers, professors, members of the Synod needed to sign the brief statement of our doctrinal position, which was from 1932. And that caused such a ruckus that in the 62 convention it was withdrawn. But the tension is there. 59 is also the year when Dr. Martin Charlemagne, veteran professor, extremely well educated, an excellent teacher on this faculty, issued a number of essays and spoke at a number of conferences. In one of them, and I think I retain the actual words of one of his opening statements, in this essay I propose to defend the paradox that the Bible, the book of God's truth, contains errors. And without reading anything else, it hit Missouri with quite a jolt. There was a lot of talking in those days about what are we going to do with Brother Charlemagne. And the many faculty colleagues who defended what he said and his advocacy of the use of historical exegesis in the classroom and so on. By 1962, Dr. Charlemagne stood in front of the convention of the Missouri Synod in Cleveland and withdrew his essay and apologized to the Synod for any trouble he had caused. But I know, because he was my friend later on, that he never really apologized for his doctrinal position in those essays, not in any very strong way. He felt he could have said them better and so on. And later on, of course, as you know, he became one of the stalwart defenders of the seminary over against the new faculty that went to Seminex. So Dr. Charlemagne's his style to some extent, his essay, his point of view, contributed very much to unrest in the Synod. The formation of the Commission on Theology and Church Relations took place in 1962 to remove from this seminary its heretofore dominance as a reservoir of all wisdom and truth. Whenever there were problems in the olden days, my first year or two on the faculty, you know, we had to rule on the question of intercessory prayers on behalf of the dead. And if you could read Latin, it wasn't so bad, because most of the argument was between Peepcorn and Stalky of Springfield, and it was in Latin. But the CTCR, all these things to show you that already there was a lot of rumbling, a lot of essays, a lot of profs at pastors' conferences. And it was about that time as well that Herman Otten, I think he should be mentioned, and recognized that he was not certified by this faculty for the ministry in 1959 or 60, I never remember the exact year, and nevertheless received a call to Trinity New Haven, and somebody ordained him, not officially of course, and he has continued to publish a journal, a magazine, originally called Lutheran News, but then Christian News, that without doubt contributed a lot because of its Xeroxing and copying of what people were saying, contributed a lot to the sense that there were problems. The well, we've got to bring this to a point where I can stop and you can start. 1969, let's mention, we probably should mention that at the last few years in the 60s, I had been away for 2 years doing my doctoral work at Yale, and was astonished when I came back in 68 to find the character of the faculty had changed quite a bit. This was before Dr. Teachin came. There were some new professors who were sort of tired of telling the church that we were doing brief statement theology here and wanted to come clean, you might say, with a more liberal view that they had. At any rate, during the 68-69 school year, Dr. Repp stood up, who was our academic dean, stood up in Pritzlaff one day at a faculty meeting and very casually said, "I think we ought to begin thinking about electing Dr. Fearbringer's successor as president. There's some rumbling out in the church. We don't know how that's going to turn out. I think we better have his successor in place before we go to the convention in Denver in 1969. And suddenly they agreed, and at the next meeting elected a committee. And to show you that I was not regarded as a total radical, I was one of the people elected to the presidential search committee at that time. A lot of people were nominated. I was told that I had received more than 100 nominations, for example, which I thought was a big joke. I was only 37 years old. And Dr. Charlemagne, who had actively campaigned for the position, we were told, had over 60 votes. But in the election itself, the electors decided not to elect anybody from the current faculty. Lest the election cause a bad feelings or something within the faculty. And out of that meeting came the election of Dr. John Teachin, who at that time was the head of the Public Relations Department of the Lutheran Council, USA, an Easterner, the editor of the American Lutheran, which was the predecessor of the so-called Lutheran Forum magazine. And that election contributed to the sense that, wow, where is this seminary going? The faculty was, I'll tell you as an insider, was absolutely joyful after that election in May of 69 for 2 months. You know, the idea that this seminary was going to emerge from its cocoon under John's leadership, take its place in the ecumenical movement, and all of that was very strong. And one thing changed all that. That was that in July, just a month or two later, Dr. J.A.O. Preuss, the president of Springfield Seminary, a man who was known to be very solid in his theological viewpoint, was elected president of the Synod, defeating Dr. Oliver Harms, a rather nice, kindly man who really didn't know, I don't believe to this day, what was really going on theologically here. At any rate, thus began what some see as this titanic struggle between Dr. Preuss and Dr. Teachin, and I have a lot of opinions on that, but perhaps I ought to just at least real quickly, even though I'm a little bit over the time Larry wanted me to quit. The school year right before, during which the walkout occurred, if we could jump to that sort of quickly, after just a brief background, right after his election, Dr. Preuss decided to investigate the teachings of the faculty. And the group that did that was a committee appointed by him called the Fact-Finding Committee. Later to be president of this seminary, Dr. Carl Barth was a member of that committee, a former professor, we called him Red. H. Armin Mollering was a member, parish pastor, member of that committee, and so were three or four others. Interviewed all of us for at least an hour, maybe 2 hours, to find out where we stood. And the faculty reacted to that with great, I don't know how to say it, with great excessive rhetoric, scolding Preuss, scolding everybody. I think to this day a piece of me that Dr. Preuss really wanted to do was to have some evidence, one way or the other, as to the question that had been agitating out in the church for a long time. Is this seminary faithful to Synod's position or is it not? And if there are a few here who aren't, then let's identify them so we can get to work on it. And yet it became the one thing I know he used to tell people, including me, that happened, that he never counted on, was that the whole thing went public. Because in July of that year that he announced this in 1970, in July of that year, the news broke in a local newspaper, the Globe Democrat in those days, of this fact-finding committee. And the man who wrote the story was a former student here, Bob Teuscher, and it soon became national news that here was this president poking his nose in here. It worried accreditors. It caused a lot of problems, but he went ahead with it. And by 1973, the convention of the Synod had backed Preuss's investigation, and Dr. Preuss had asked me, as one of his staff persons, to write a document that would show the Board of Regents, many of whose members were laity, where the Missouri Synod stood officially on the questions that had been addressed in the fact-finding committee interviews. And that job fell to me. I was given the transcripts, 1,400 pages or something like that, of all the professors' interviews. I asked the secretary to take names off so that I would never know which of my colleagues' interviews I was reading, and had the task of identifying questions that had been asked, issues that had been raised, responses that had been given, and I remember arranging it, the actual writing I did in 2 nights after staying up kind of late, 3 o'clock or something, and Dr. Preuss came in, he says, Ralph, how are you doing on that thing? I need it to give to the Board of Regents so that they know where we stand. We have to go out there tomorrow. And I said, well, I have a draft, but my goodness, it hasn't gone through any nitpicking or any questioning or anything. Anyhow, he said, I want it. And he got it and met with the vice presidents and a few others. They eliminated one whole section on church fellowship. I've got to write this story for the journal someday. At any rate, that too is another important chapter. That document went on to be adopted by the New Orleans Convention in 1973 as an official doctrinal position of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, along with the brief statement, the Common Confession, and a few others, and it caused all kinds of consternation. The 73 convention was extremely painful convention for anyone who was there. Not only did it adopt that statement, which in effect condemned the teachings of so many professors, but it also, in Resolution 309, my fellow board members will remember how another board member, Walter Disson, when we were interviewing professors, it would come to be his turn, and he would say, where do you stand on 309? And knees would begin to wobble and said, what's 309? He'd say, don't know what 309 is? And these persons, you would think they'd flunk the interview. That was the resolution at New Orleans that condemned the doctrinal position of the faculty majority. And Resolution 3-12, instead of kicking out John Teachin on the floor of a convention, which, thank goodness, did not happen, it instructed the Board of Regents to get on with it. Well, before to handle, you know, it didn't exactly say what the outcome should be, but it was kind of a foregone conclusion. Two members of that floor committee, Pastor Leonard Bulow, Pastor Harlan Harnap, then took charges that had come out of the work of the floor committee and formally presented them to the Board of Regents and in the 73 school year. Meanwhile, on July 24, 1973, just a few days after the convention, the faculty began with one of its famous media events, gathering people at the feet of Luther out here in the Luther statue parking lot to read a protest statement against what had been done at New Orleans, stating that their doctrine was okay, that they weren't going to withhold or retract anything, and so on. The board responded by saying, you shouldn't have done that. Withdraw that statement. The Board of Higher Education said to the faculty, you shouldn't have done it. Please withdraw it. Came the October meeting of the board. The board decided to begin moving. They had no response, and they retired a whole bunch of professors who had turned 65. Peepcorn, Kemmerer, Werfel, Bowman, I'm missing a couple. They failed to renew the contract of a professor who was rather popular by the name of Paul Getting, and also advised the faculty that from that point on, every course syllabus had to be approved by the Board of Regents. Dr. Teachin's administration did not like that, and the students didn't like it, and there were meetings and protests, and then the board set December 17th as its meeting. It was widely assumed that that's the meeting when when the suspension of Dr. Teachin will take place, and the only speculation was when and so on. Something happened in December of that year. Dr. Peepcorn died on the 13th, I think it was, of September. Well-known professor, kind of a symbol of what was going on. And the board, rather than interfere with the funeral and the grieving for Professor Peepcorn, canceled its meeting over Dr. Teachin's protest and postponed it to January. And that brings us back to where I was before. In January, the board, you know, the suspension of Dr. Teachin. By the way, suspension of a professor to this very day is not a firing of the professor. It means that he has he's in a situation that threatens himself or the institution. And he's kept on full salary, And his case is tried. A faculty hearings committee is appointed, and lots of stuff has to go on before there's a finding of guilty or not guilty and all of that. Anyhow, it was the suspension of Dr. Teachin, coming on the heels of Dr. Peepcorn's death, coming on the heels of protest statements, the New Orleans Convention, that led to the walkout. There's a whole another book to be talked about, but I shan't, on the rebuilding of Concordia Seminary. The stories are somewhat humorous in a sense, but just quickly, the Lord, to me, it's I don't talk often in terms of miracle, other than those I can know about for sure from the scriptures, especially the two big ones, the resurrection of our Lord and the gift of new life in me. But the recovery from all of this was, I think, nothing short of a miracle. There were just a few of us here. Students pitched in. Dr. Robert, my first job, for example, I was elected on the 20th of February, 20th of May, I was in a CTCR meeting, didn't finish that till Wednesday. Came out Thursday, not knowing what a president does, I'm not sure I ever did find out, but went in the president's office, said, "Hi, Helen, we're going to be working together. Anything I should know?" She said, "Well, take a look at your at the office, the president's office." Well, they were using that for caps and gowns for commencement the next night. So my first official duty was to preside at commencement. 37 students were graduated, and I made the announcement that earlier that day, Dr. Robert Price, who had distinguished himself as a professor here and leader here for so many years, had been elected president of the Springfield Seminary that afternoon. He left the next morning at 6 a.m. or so, and so my break-in period was very short, and it took place on the stage of commencement, for all intents and purposes. We faced a tremendous financial problem. The fee income alone of 400-some students suddenly being gone is over $450,000 a year. We right away went to the board of directors and say, "Could you give us a guarantee, not any money, just a guarantee that if we need it, you'll provide it until we get on our feet," and they did. We faced the loss of our accreditation. Dr. Teachin was on the executive committee of the ATS. Dr. Rep, the dean, had been. They met on June 3rd to take the regular meeting. They did a lot of other things, but one of the big issues was what this terrible board had done. And so I had to stand up there and try to persuade them, "Please don't kick us out. Don't take our accreditation away. Put us on, suspend us if you must so that we can rebuild. I promise you, we will use your expertise. We will hire your consultants. We want to do it right." Think of what happened as what the attorneys in those days called an act of God. You didn't have to be religious to believe in an act of God. An earthquake, a tornado, something just, hit this campus, and now we want to rebuild. Help us. And lo and behold, they did. And that was nice. Well, mostly it was students. We only had a few months. Where were they going to come from? Well, would you believe it? In this room, in early September 1974, we began that school year with a whole bunch of new profs who weren't that fond of coming to teach. They loved their parishes for the most part or their previous positions. But we opened that school year with 194 students and I think 14 new professors, and every seat filled. Gene and Charlie and others will remember that. I still remember my sermon. That's very unusual. Yeah. Revelations 3. I've only, I think, preached on it one other time, and that was my last night in China in 1985. "Behold, I have set before you an open door, which no one can shut, because you have kept my word and not denied my name." And those are wonderful words. They're words for today, tomorrow, and for years to come. You have I believe, followed in that succession of this seminary's wonderful tradition and leadership by honoring God's word and by confessing his name, and you've done it with grace and distinction, and I'm among those today who am extremely proud of all of you, the men and women of the faculty and staff and the student body, and I pray that God will continue to bless you for many, many years to come. Larry, I think I'd better stop for some comments. I mean, there's not much time left.
Questions, please, from the microphones.
Dr. Bowman, what do you think the Synod has learned in the matter of conflict resolution as a consequence of those events of 25 years ago?
I don't know whether we've learned very much from it. And it's ironic, I mean, to have that much hurt and pain and disruption. You know, it eventually, the placement problem led to a splinter, a split in Missouri Synod. Roughly 110,000 people, 100-plus pastors formed the Association of Evangelical Lutheran Churches that then became a part of the new Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. And I often say that a split and all that pain and heartache, did we learn anything? Well, I think so, in the sense of a stronger, clearer position on the Scriptures and their authority. I believe we learned from the point of view that we heard most often from Seminex folks was the priority of the gospel in our lives and theology. And though we often differed as to what all that meant, I believe there's a sense in which that gospel priority business has also helped us a little bit. But we'd never learned, there's still problems that we didn't get to in that controversy that I think will come up because we didn't address them. For example, the implications of the variety of literary forms in the Scripture for the belief that the Scriptures are infallible and inerrant. We should have found a way of addressing some of that. And what we didn't learn was to look each other in the eye when we disagree and to keep looking with the Scriptures open and the testimony of the Fathers, including the Confessions, and the guidance of the Spirit, and keep going with conversation until we have settled it. We had a walkout. It ended it. There was no more questioning of the New Orleans resolution. So did we learn anything? I don't know. We learned that it's very bitter to be in controversy. I think you still see that. Large parts of this Synod want no part whatsoever of anything controversial. Pastors' conferences, you know, they shy away. This may cause a problem. Or George over there in that parish, you know, he looks at these things a little more traditionally than I do. Or Fred's got some far out ideas about that. I'm just going to keep quiet about it. I mean, that's not a good learning if we learn that. Let's hope so. I mean, let's hope we've learned to have a stronger theology of the Word and of grace, but I'm not also sure that we did. Were you next? Please.
First off, I'd like to thank you for coming here and speaking to us.
Well, thank you.
Your presentation helps put into perspective things that I have seen but not always understood, being 9 years old when all this took place. Not old enough to understand the theology, but old enough to see the grimaces and the emotion on the face of a lot of Midwestern farmers who wondered what was going on. My question for you today is there some common thread that, looking back, you could see that there was amongst the faculty minority that set them apart, maybe in their training, or something that this is sort of what led to their holding fast the authority of Scripture. Someone had once told me that all of the minority were of the same systematics department, and someone said, no, that's not true. Is there anything that was common?
I was going to mention that, but you've already shot that down. It is true, and it is striking that four of the five so-called faculty minority, maybe I can say a word as to why and how that came about, but four of the five were systematics people. The fifth was Dr. Charlemagne, who was an exegete. And to some extent, I think it is a little bit of a, you know, theologically, this is fundamentally a theological conflict. I mean, those who want to describe it in terms of two different personalities, you know, Preuss and Teach, and okay, they were both charismatic individuals and all of that. Preuss was not the mean guy he was portrayed to be. He was a very kind man. He had a hard time, he was political, had a hard time, though, being tough. And Teachin, I in a sense always kind of liked Teachin. I didn't know whether I could fully believe everything, but and for me, a lot of my problem with the faculty colleagues was moral. Some of it just wasn't truthful. I mean, that's how we happened to have a faculty minority. One day we showed up at a faculty meeting, and a document had been prepared by a committee to be sent to the entire church stating that Dr. Preuss's fact-finding committee was not at all necessary because there were no serious theological problems within the faculty. And, I couldn't believe this, because in the very meeting, one of our dear colleagues stood up and says, "You really think I can sign this? I mean, you know where I stand on the confession's notion that there's predictive prophecy. I don't agree with that at all." Somebody else stood up and said, "Oh, you can sign that. That's okay." We had obvious differences. And the one reason the systematics people tended to band together was because we had many conversations with the exegetes. I began here as a prof at the age of 28 in 1960. Dr. Spitz, who's now in heaven, we buried him just a few years ago at 90-something, was chairman, and we had many meetings between the systematicians and the exegetes on these differences. That's where I thought this thing should go, with continued internal discussion. You just keep working at it until you reach some clarity. But that is one part of it. There were also, however, a number of systematicians who were not part of the minority. So the common thread, I think, might be a kind of, without implying that anybody who saw it differently was dishonest. But there, look at those five people. All of us, I believe, would be characterized as men who liked to tell the truth and tell it as straightforwardly as we could, and didn't want to tell the church that there are no problems when there are problems. We felt it would have been better to say, yes, we have some problems and we're working on them. Trust us to work them out. And if President Preuss can help us do that, we welcome his help, instead of trying to disgrace him and discredit him. By the way, we were given 24 hours in that meeting. Anybody who could not sign this statement had 24 hours to report to the president's office as to why not. Four of us had our offices. That's another one. We had our offices in E, which is the business office today. So after that meeting, we said, wow, we got hit with a bombshell. Not only can't we sign it, we have 24 hours. We decided to sign something together. And somebody said, well, let's call Robert Preuss. He voted against that too. His office was in Seek. And Robert came over, and the five of us sat there. We're all late for dinner, still in our wives' doghouse for that. But we wrote this little bitty statement that said why we hadn't signed it, and then read about ourselves in the newspaper 2 days later, that one of the officers' administration was looking for positions for us elsewhere and junk like that. Thus began the minority. I mean, I don't know anything in common, you ask. We were men who wanted to tell the truth to the church. I don't, we never at any time wanted a walkout or anything. No one did. I'm talking too long in response. Are there others? Yes, please. Please don't hesitate to interrupt me.
Thank you very much. The perception is that, I believe there may be a perception that a lot of the laity that was involved in church at that time really had no understanding of what was going on, may not have appreciated the fullness of the situation, and even to this day may not understand the amount of angst that was going on between different factions and why it ever happened. Did the Synod do enough to get that information out? And also, in looking at today's issues, are we doing enough to get out our Synod's positions when we have factions of liberal and conservative in the Missouri Synod? Are we doing enough to articulate our positions?
I don't know. I really doubt that you can ever do enough. But as one who has tried, and there are many of you who have, you're going to find it as pastors too. It's very hard to get people interested in some of this stuff. I mean, even in the 70s, when, or 60s, if you will, when these issues began to become very explosive, people didn't want to believe it. You know, how do you get them into it? There were a lot of meetings in those days, board members, faculty members. We were invited here and there and everywhere. I remember doing district pastors' conferences with my friend Ed Krentz on the other side, and he'd speak and I'd speak, and you know, that kind of thing. But I don't think so. I don't think we do a very good job of it, and I don't think the people, particularly since the walkout, are very eager to hear controversy. They want to shy away from it. My theory, it was idealistic when I became acting president, was let's do it right. That is to say, we're called here to teach these young men to be pastors of the church, to love the Lord, to honor His word, to keep His confessions. Let's be the kind of place where if you have questions about it or disagree, you can be open about it. We won't put you down. We'll let you work that through. That's what one thing that seminary is supposed to do. And show by our example and our graduates' example what it means to honor the Scriptures as Word of God, what it means to teach the primacy of Christ. Don't talk about the past and don't gloat about it. Talk about the future. Just be confessional. Well, that's okay. I mean, that's still a basic part of it, and that's still going on in, you know, wide areas of our church. But I don't think we've learned very well to talk about each other in a Christian way. One of the great scars on the history of this church body, not only for 25 years but more, is the continued publication of materials that shamelessly break the Eighth Commandment by destroying people's lives and reputations instead of engaging them in conversation, so much so that you almost think it's commonplace, that it's okay to, if a brother writes something wrong, to kind of blast him to kingdom come, to score points. Politics began in dead earnest in the 60s as well, and I don't know that that's been an unmitigated blessing for the church. This is a highly politicized church, particularly at the national level. And I think until we can break through that and return to a more even-handed, low-keyed way of working to elect our leaders and so on, we're going to have problems too. Larry, you keep, let's not use that clock, but you keep an eye on it, and we have a brother here yet. Hi.
Thank you for speaking to us, Dr. Bowman. Looking at the times, the 60s and 70s in the United States as a whole, how much did the spirit of the times contribute to maybe the attitudes of the majority and the attitudes of the students in the kind of the protest movement of the walkout?
It's a very perceptive question. Some used to wonder why Martin Charlemagne changed from being, you know, the bad guy in 1959 defending a thesis that the Book of God's Truth contains error, to being a great stalwart defender of the truth and of Missouri's position just 10 years later. Part of that was the 60s. Martin was a reserve general, brigadier general. Maybe you didn't know that. Brigadier general as a chaplain, a military man, had a great military career as a chaplain. And he was a law and order man. And a lot of what went on right here was not lawful and orderly. I mean, the rules say that the synod, you know, confesses what it wants to believe, teach, and confess. And when it calls men to be professors and students to be pastors, well, the understanding is that we do this in terms of the synod's position. By the way, that's a big point in this whole thing that I didn't dwell on. But one of the things the faculty had come to do, I was a member of it and I know it from the inside out, it saw itself as the leader of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. It expected the president of the synod to kind of be a part of the social world, but certainly of the leadership world of the seminary, and not the other way around. And if you couldn't get the leadership of the synod to kind of help, support, and advertise what was going on at the seminary, then you had to get different leaders. And that is a very important lesson, that a seminary cannot be allowed, in my judgment, to lead the church in any authoritarian way. Where seminaries are here to serve the church. And of course that you do that sometimes by asking hard questions of the church. Maybe we're not right in everything we do as a church, but you do it in a respectful way. So that was a part of the problem. And I veered away from your question. Would you say it one more time so that I don't... Did you mean the 60s?
The 60s, yeah. And the early 70s were in Vietnam, yeah, at the time, and
sure,
starting to pull out.
We were very much a part of that. I remember sitting in this room next to Martin Fronsman. Right over there were Hank Rowalt and Phyllis and Bob Colbert sitting about. This is before Dr. Teachin's election. We had a three-day moratorium on classes here in 1969, that because the students were so upset with the way they perceived classes to be taught and lack of freedom in the curriculum, and it was kind of vintage 60s stuff. So to some extent, that was a part of it. I mean, protests were common. To this day, I don't believe that the faculty who walked off with 400 students on the 19th of February really thought they were going to be gone very long. I mean, there was a picture in Exodus and Concordia of them leaving at 12:05, and then lower on the page, many of them coming back to have lunch at the dining hall. You know, it was kind of a tongue-in-cheek, maybe a little sarcastic, but I really don't think they thought it would be long. Part of that stemmed from arrogance. That is to say, how can they possibly survive without us? I mean, how can they run this seminary without us? We're the teachers of the church. So, I mean, our first instinct, the board's and mine and my faculty colleagues, was just to survive. But part of it was also to demonstrate, again, for the sake of the church, that this is the church's seminary and not that the church exists for the seminary. I don't know. Spirit of the times, to some extent. I think so. I bet you want to eat. Thank you so much for sitting so quietly.
Would you join me in thanking Dr. Bowman for being with us?